time for The Outspoken Cyclist, the weekly conversation about cycles, cyclists, travel, trails, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. WJCU broadcasts and streams The Outspoken Cyclist on-air show at 8 a.m. every Saturday morning. In Northeast Ohio, tune in to 88.7 FM, or worldwide, listen in at WJCU.org. Our weekly podcast is available at the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, or download it with your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for November 7th, 2020, and hopefully it's a respite from the past week. Today, I welcome Paul Brody. His handle is Fussy Frame Builder, and at one time, Paul Brody's business produced hundreds of frames. Paul, who was originally born in England and has lived in British Columbia now for most of his life, has transitioned from producing frames to teaching frame building to starring in videos on his YouTube channel with over 2,000 subscribers. Watching Paul as he goes through his processes offers a glimpse into the expertise he has, as well as a style of instruction that's easy to follow and not so technically scary to even the novice like me. We cover a wide variety of topics, including his answers to my three questions about food, music, and pets, and I think you'll enjoy the conversation. Then we have the first of our three-part series on gifts for the holidays with Bicycling Magazine's test editor, Lou Mazzanti. This week, we'll look at a few gifts under $25. Lou will be with me later in the show. From fabricating brake levers from scratch to extending a steerer tube, Paul Brody's teaching style is casual and explicit. And he's about as guileless in conversation as anyone I've ever spoken with in a very long time, if ever. And wait till you hear about his pets. Hello, Paul. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being my guest this week. How are you?
I'm very good, Diane, and thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. Can we start with your background, where you grew up, how bicycles became your thing? And then we'll talk about frame building and some of the other things the Fussy Frame Builder has been doing.
Sure, we can do that. I was born in England, and our family moved over here to Vancouver when I was nine. I got interested in motorcycles when I was nine, and that continued for quite a while. And then it was when I was about 16 or 17, that's when I got an interest in bicycles. That's when the 10-speed craze hit, if you remember that.
I do. I'm old.
Yep. Everybody was just nuts about these bikes with these drop bars, and I had to have one too. So that's kind of how my interest in real bicycling started.
Did you ever race bikes?
Yes, I did. I still got a trophy. When I was 17, I went down and I did a road race. I was a complete novice. I looked back at the photos and I had cut off jeans. I had sneakers. I had a little leather helmet. I don't think I wore any gloves. And I still remember the first race I was in. I was a novice and we had to go up the road. It was a double lane road up by UBC, and then we had to turn around and come back, and I knew nothing about racing, and we turned the corner, which I thought was the halfway, and I thought, I'm going to sprint now. So I did. I sprinted into the lead, and then I got extremely tired, and then everybody passed me, and then we went back down to the start finish line, and that's when I realized that, oh, we're going to do two laps now. I see. Out of my league. And so the next race I went in, I was a wheel sucker. I didn't take my turn at the front at all. And somehow in the sprint, I got the win. I don't know how that happened, but that's how I got the trophy. And then I didn't race after that. When I started making frames, that was about a dozen years later. That's when I started racing, a cross-country mountain bike.
Hmm.
I did that for 9 years, so I feel like I definitely put my time in, and I was always middle of the pack. I was never last. I was never first, just always in the pack somewhere, but that was fine.
Well, if you were happy with it, I mean, what else is there? You were out there doing your thing. I like that.
Yeah, it was good. That was a lot of good rides. So
nice. Talk to me about frame building, when you got into frame building and how that came about.
My very first frame I made when I was 12 years old, it was not a bicycle frame. It was a mini bike. It was about 1967, and the world was going kind of nutty about little mini bikes, and I had to have one. So I couldn't afford a brand new one. So I scrounged up parts, and I had some help from my father, and that was my first frame.
Huh. Yeah, but now you do something way more sophisticated than that, I would say.
Yeah, I've been making things out of metal now for 53 years, so I've got a pretty good background. I started making things out of metal when I was 12, so it just continued. I just never stopped making things out of metal, and I got into frame building in 1984. I was working for Rocky Mountain. I got a job at Rocky Mountain, and I was sort of the handyman in the bicycle shop, and Rocky Mountain was renting the space out back of the shop, and they were importing a lot of Italian things like Gucciotti frames and clothing, and then they bought Norman Hill Frame Building Operation, and they had a builder there. He was Derek Bailey. He was an eccentric Englishman, and they needed a spray painter. And I said, well, I don't have any experience. And they said, well, we don't know anybody else. So I went out there and I taught myself how to paint. And then I realized that there was an opportunity to build mountain bike frames because mountain bikes were just starting to sell up in Vancouver. So I talked myself into that position, and they were very, very skeptical, but I figured out how to build a frame. Derek Bailey, he was out there. He was the road guy. And the first thing he said to me was, I'm not going to show you anything. So there was that whole situation of an older person with knowledge not wanting to share.
That's so bicycle industry. I just don't understand it. It just makes me crazy when I hear this kind of stuff. It's like, what do you think you're hiding?
Well, I guess it comes from insecurity. If I show you what I do, and if you do it well, maybe I won't be here anymore or something like that. But I realized that even if I show someone how to do something, it doesn't mean that they can actually do it, because you need to have to have the skills with your hand. You need experience. You need some kind of understanding of the metal or the medium you're dealing with. So if I show people things, it's a way of sharing, but it doesn't mean necessarily that they can just make what I just made.
Right. Let me remind listeners, I'm speaking with Paul Brody, the Fussy Frame Builder, and if you haven't seen any of his videos, we'll talk about them a little bit later in our conversation, but I watched several of your videos, and they're just fascinating. I mean, I watch my husband, who's a frame builder, occasionally, but actually, I probably should watch him more. I used to love that stuff, but now I'm not in the shop as much anymore. Anyway, you know what? You were credited with the sloping top tube design. So are you mainly self-taught, and was that something that you came up with on your own?
I am self-taught mostly, and the sloping top tube design, it goes back to the 1890s. I got a book called Bicycles and Tricycles by Archibald Sharp, and it's a well-spent book.
We have that on our shelf.
Yeah, it's a great book, but just, you know, even if you just sort of glance through it, I don't understand all the physics he gets into and that, but, you know, sloping top tubes and one-sided forks and all that kind of stuff, it was all done so long ago. So I did not invent a sloping top tube at all, but I guess I had an interest in it, and I helped make it.
Well, certainly it continues today. I mean, I don't see too many level top tube bikes, even in road and gravel and certainly mountain for sure. So if people started following you, whether Archibald did it back then or not, I think it's pretty innovative for this time. Who were some of the other people who influenced your work?
Well, when I started working at Rocky Mountain was the big importer of Tom Ritchie frames. And so what I saw of hand-built was all Tom Ritchie. So anytime when I was trying to figure out something when I was working on frames, how to build a jig or whatever, always the thought that went through my mind was, how would Tom do this? You don't know how many times I said Tom did it. So I have to say that Tom Ritchie, even though he was miles away in California, he had a big influence on me making frames. When I was teaching frame building 101 in the last few years, and I would talk about Tom Ritchie, and often the students would get a blank look on their face, like, who's Tom Ritchie? And I'm thinking, wow, we sure forget, or we just don't know, because I think a lot gets lost over the years. Unless someone is promoting something and keeping it in the public's eye, things really disappear these days.
I watched an interview he did, I think it was in Europe. I don't think it was here. I think it was in Germany, actually. And he's an interesting guy. I've had him on the show, and he certainly was one of those innovators back in the day. And you're right, that if you're not in front of people right now, you fade into the background, which is kind of strange. It's sort of like with the internet, you have to be there every minute. It's really kind of weird, very weird. So what kinds of innovations in bicycle frames most impress you or have impressed you that maybe you've carried forward or you've modified in some way?
I saw that question, which you sent to me, and what came to my mind was when I saw on the cover of, I think, Mountain Bike Action, Richard Cunningham of Mantis Bikes. We're basically going back a lot of years. This is probably late 80s, early 90s, and he came up with the elevated chainstay design.
Right. Hmm.
And my first thought was, wow, I wish I had thought of that. And it seemed to be brilliant, because it seemed like it solved all the problems of the chain stock and the length of the chainstay, but then ultimately the frames broke, so it wasn't a good idea ultimately. But I just remember how it really kind of hit me that what a great design. That was my first thought, but ultimately no.
When you saw that elevated chainstay design and it didn't work, was there something from it that you could take from it and turn it into something that did work? Or did you use it as sort of the basis for anything?
No, I just looked at it, and I think the problem was the seat tube had to be so heavy and strong to hold the seat up high.
Okay.
I think that was the problem. But just to look at it, it was, at the time, I remember thinking how innovative it was, and it was certainly a fresh look at things. So that's what came to my mind when I looked at that question.
Okay. So I did watch one of your videos. You were extending a steerer tube, which was fascinating, by the way. I watched every minute of it. And you said something about your TIG welding, and yet I know you usually braze your bike. So what is your preference? Do you have a preference of TIG over brazing, or is it just whatever you need at the moment?
Each has its place. And of all the frames we made over the 15-year period when I was really active in the business, probably 90% of them were TIG welded, because it was just a more efficient process. You didn't have to wait for the tubes to come up to temperature. You didn't have to stand the fillet, things like that. I like both right now. I'm not actually building a whole lot of frames now. I just made a frame for myself, and I've got a friend who wants me to make him a frame, but I'm not actually in production, I wouldn't say. I like both. I like the Philip Braid for its artisticness. I like the Tick for its speed and economy. You don't have to spend nearly as much time in the finishing or the prep. So it's good.
Is one more technically difficult than the other?
Well, when I'm teaching Frame Building 101, I say I can teach anyone how to braze. And every student who came through the course and brazed always left with a finished frame. On TIG welding, it's very hard to learn how to TIG weld in 2 days, 3 days. So I think the brazing takes longer, and you have to learn how to file. But the TIG welding, you really need really good eyesight, really good hand-eye coordination, and you got to have a steady hand and be very careful. It's more technical than the brazing, I would say.
Okay. All right, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to speak with Paul Brody some more. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. The Outspoken Cyclist is proud to have Bike Law as a trusted partner. If you find yourself in need of legal advice or assistance as it pertains to any cycling issue, log on to bikelaw.com. We are back on the show. If you're just joining me, I am speaking with the Fussy Frame Builder. I love that. It just is such a cool handle. Paul Brody, he's up in British Columbia. And I wanted to ask you a little bit. You mentioned in the first part of our conversation that you are no longer producing frames on a quote-unquote production basis. I know you actually sold your business. You had a big staff. You were producing many, many frames every year. So why did you get out of the production business? Why did you decide to do what you're doing now, which I think is awesome because it allows you a lot more freedom, I think. But there have to be other reasons, perhaps.
I think a large part of it was the financial. It just got really hard to compete with offshore frames. I had a distributor at the time, and I went around there, and he would tell me that he could buy a frame out of Taiwan that was painted and clear coated, and he could buy the entire frame for $35 US. At that point, I was buying tubing, and each set of tubing and bottom bracket and braze ons and dropouts would cost me $140. And that's with no labor whatsoever. So it just got really hard to compete. And I don't think I was alone, because almost all of the other small builders, we all kind of faded away in a sense. And we were building runs of frames. We'd do runs of 10 at a time, you know, sometimes 20. But I think most builders now are doing a custom frame at a time. I don't think many or any builders now that do runs of 10. Not that I know of.
No, me neither.
I feel pretty fortunate to be around at the time when the bicycle business, the mountain bike business, just took off. It was incredible, because there was a time when it first started. Well, for me, that was in the late 80s, and we went to a trade show in Germany. I think it was Friedrichshafen, and we had people coming by and wanting to buy 100 frames. It was like all you could make, you could sell. Well, that sure changed a lot as mountain biking matured. I should have done my homework. I should have looked at history, because every industry has its start, its rise, and its fall. And for me, and I think many other people in the mountain bike industry at the time, in the late 80s and early 90s, we just thought it would go on forever.
Sure.
And that's not how the world works.
No, it isn't.
The rise and the fall, and I guess I didn't do my history. So right at the peak, right when it was about to go down, that's when I moved the company into a much larger shop in the anticipation of business continuing that upward trend. It didn't do that, and now I had the big rent. I made mistakes along the way, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think we all do, but fortunately, some of us actually learn from those mistakes, and then there are others who do not. You now actually, or you were before COVID, you were actually teaching frame building at the University of Fraser Valley. How did you decide to start teaching the art of frame building, which, of course, I believe it's an art also. I mean, there is some, of course, science to it, but it is an artistic pursuit.
Well, I got into that, and that was not my plan. How the story goes, and this is all in my book, I was working on a lot of motorcycles, and I hadn't used my frame jigs, my bicycle frame building jigs for about 5 years. And I came into the house. If I put an ad on Craigslist and I sold my jigs, I thought I could get $8,000 and I could buy myself a new trial bike. And so, sort of on a whim, I took some photos and I put the ad on Craigslist, and I got this amazing response that I thought mistakenly that a Craigslist was kind of local, but it's not. Craigslist is huge because in 12 hours, I had a response from Sweden and Switzerland, and there was a mountain bike website in England that put the ad on its front page. And so suddenly there was this huge buzz going, but the frame jigs never sold. And so 2 weeks later, I had a call from my friend, Brent Martin. He's the guy that won the 86th championship on a Brody bike, and that's what really helped to launch the bike. Well, he's not a frame builder. He was in the eyeglass business, but he bought the jigs, and because he told me that I should teach bicycle frame building. So I thought my life was going down one path, and then suddenly it's making a sharp right-hand turn, you might say. So we started to do some research on who could host this new frame building program, and we tried a couple schools, and they either didn't have the space or weren't quite interested. And then I thought, well, there's got to be someone out in the Fraser Valley. So I went online, and there was the University of Fraser Valley. And right on the front page, it said, if you are interested in teaching a course, please contact us. So I made a phone call. We had a breakfast meeting, and that's how it all started. It was not my idea. It was Brent Martin.
And when was that?
That was in 2009, something like that. So It took about half a year to get all the details worked out, and then I had to set the shop up. I did quite a bit of work on my own, and the first course was in September of 2010.
That's so cool. Let me remind listeners once again, we're speaking with Paul Brody. He is up in British Columbia, taught frame building at the University of Fraser Valley. How many students would you say have gone through the course in the past, well, until COVID, of course, shut it down?
Over 9.5 years, I did 65 courses and probably maybe an average of three students a class. I mean, you know, sometimes I had four, sometimes I had two, sometimes I even had one. That's not so good. But so I'd say maybe 160, 180 people, something like that.
Yeah. If you were to enroll, how long would it take to get through the whole course?
It was Monday to Friday, 8 till 4, and it was 2 weeks long.
Is Fraser Valley a community college, or is it a full-blown university? It says University of Fraser Valley.
It's a university. It used to be called UFCD, a college. It was like a college before, and then probably 8 years ago, it became a full-fledged university.
Nice.
So I was under the continuing studies program.
I think that bicycle mechanics, bicycle frame building, wheel building, all of those things are great college course options that a lot of other colleges should offer. And I'm glad to hear that this one was until, of course, ta-da, COVID. So what changed when COVID hit up there? Did they shut the university down?
I think some parts got shut down. There were also other changes going along. Because the course used to be $2,950, and then I got a new boss. Old boss more or less went on a sabbatical, and my new boss decided that he was going to raise the price to $4,950.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. It's a 66% increase, and so I wasn't very happy with that, and I was suspicious that it wouldn't fly. And so my first course is at the new price in March, and nobody signed up, and then COVID hit. So it was kind of like a double whammy in a way. And at first I was quite upset that no one had signed up, and it felt like I was losing the course. But then COVID hit, and I realized that every teacher or in shutting down classes or a lot of changes. So then I didn't feel so bad. And then I decided that, well, if I'm not teaching, I want to do something. And so that's when the YouTube came into the picture.
Your videos are really, really good. They're easy to watch. They're fun to watch. Your shop is really interesting. I mean, I spent a lot of time watching that steer tube video, looking for all the different little nooks and crannies in your shop. So who is the person who shoots these videos for you? But you never see them, but you did introduce them at the beginning, I think.
Yeah, that's Mitch. Mitch was a student out at Frame Building 101, and that was about a year ago now. And then he lives close to me, and I noticed that often he'd be on the trail with his camera out, and he would video me as I came past. So I realized that he had a real interest in video. So I asked him if he'd be interested in helping me out with some filming. And so that's what we've done. And it worked fine so far.
It does work fine. They're really, really good videos because they're not so technical that you need a degree in engineering to know what you're doing, but yet there's a lot of technical information that's passed along in a way people can understand. So I had a question about whether what you're doing on the videos is for specific customers or just because you want to do that, like the brake levers you made that you'd never made brake levers in the past or extending the steerer tube. And I knew that was for a customer. You said it was for a tall customer.
Yeah, Eric's a friend of mine, so I was basically helping him out. And it seems like my life kind of revolves around YouTube now, because a big part of the challenge is because it's not always easy coming up with something else to do week after week. And so far, we've done 32 consecutive weeks, I think. We haven't just yet.
Wow.
I'm kind of proud of that. I think we're kind of proud of that. So I'd like to do the YouTube for a bunch more, so I'm optimistic we can keep it going. That's what I'd like.
Well, it's certainly interesting, and there are plenty of topics. Do you build wheels? Have you ever built wheels?
I've built wheels. I've built motorcycle wheels. I've built bicycle wheels. I've built hubs for motorcycles and bicycles, and I think that's going to be one of the upcoming segments, is to build a couple hubs for this antique bike that I have sitting upstairs.
Well, that sounds like fun. So you also built a custom e-mountain bike frame. Do you think that this e-bike phenomenon is going to continue to grow, and will you kind of keep looking at it?
I'm not sure if I'll build another one. I was basically helping out a university student with his thesis project, so that's how I got involved in that. I think e-bikes are here to stay. I have some older friends, and some of them just love their e-bikes because they can ride farther and longer than they could ordinarily. So I think it's a good thing. I know not everyone feels that way, but I think it's a trend that'll keep going.
We're going to take another short break, and when we come back, we're going to ask Paul some personal questions, not so much about bicycling. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
On The Outspoken Cyclist, and now we're going to turn to some things that I want to focus on you for a moment and what you're thinking going forward. So we did talk about videos. You want to keep coming up with topics for videos. Do you already have a list that you're going to be producing over the next few weeks, or are you like scrambling every week for a topic?
Next week, I think we're going to work on U-brakes. I was always a fan of U-brakes back in the day. I mean, that's what, late 80s now, showing how long I've been around.
Yeah, me too.
it's a good project to make a set of brakes. So I'm looking forward to that. After that, we'll focus on the Whippet, sort of a show and tell of the bike I made for NABS years ago. And yeah, it's just, I don't know what happens after that. It's that as long as I can come up with something, then we'll keep going.
So if people wanted to make suggestions, you'd be willing to take them, huh?
Yeah, some people have said, why don't you do this or that? But I'm thinking, well, that's not such a, I'm not sure if that's such an interesting project. I know you need something like that, it sounds like. So yeah, if someone wants to make a suggestion, sure, send it in. A fussy frame builder at gmail.com, that would work.
Yeah, it worked for me. That's how I found you. Well, actually, that's not true. I found you first on Facebook, and then you gave me that Gmail. So, yeah, I was really glad to get it. So if the university opens back up again, will you try to go back and teach, or is this price just outrageous and you're just not going to do it?
Well, since then, the price has come down to $3,950. And I was told that if I want to teach in the fall, which is now, I could. It's basically up to me. But if I was teaching you how to braze, I would have to wear my reading glasses, my brazing glasses, a mask, and a face shield. I'd have four things on my face. And just, it doesn't seem like that's something I'd really want to do. So I haven't said no to the university, but I kind of feel like I've moved on to the YouTube format.
So let me ask a question about YouTube, because I don't really know how it works. And you can decline to answer if you wish. Are you actually somehow making some sort of money from doing these YouTube videos?
That's a good question. So we've been doing this for 7 months. And you have to get 1,000 subscribers, and you need 4,000 watch hours, and then you can monetize. That's the word they use.
Right.
And so we did that recently, and so about a couple weeks ago, Mitch and I got paid for the first time in 7 months, and we each got $72.61.
Well, maybe we'll get more viewers out of the show. That would be awesome, huh?
That would be fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
That is interesting, though. I didn't know how it worked. I just knew that at some point, you know, there are people making gazillions of dollars, apparently, on YouTube. And I'm like, well, how the hell are they doing that? So what do you do when you're not in that workshop or teaching? And don't tell me, go ride your bike. You have to say something different.
Well, I've got a 5-acre property with a house and a shop. Take some upkeep, and I play chess with my neighbor. That's a hobby of mine. I've got a grand piano, and I got a bass guitar, and I need to practice both of them much more. I like photography.
Wow, you have a lot of hobbies. That's very cool.
I have lots of hobbies.
I think that's good. I think that's really good. Diversification.
I know people that have no hobbies at all, and I just kind of shake my head. I don't know how that can be, but.
How are you? Oh, you said you're playing chess with your neighbor, so you're not doing like this online chess thing.
I do online chess as well. I got a few games going. Yep, on chess.com. If you want to play me on chess.com, my name is Frame Builder.
Well, not me. Don't ask me. I haven't played chess in 40 years, and I'm not about to start now. I'm doing other stuff. Not chess. I mean, I'm cerebral, but not that much. I wish I'd learned and learned to play some of those crazy things. So if you watched The Queen's Gambit yet, it's supposed to be really, really good. It's about chess, I think, this young girl.
I just finished watching it.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, it was good. It was a little bit longer than it needed to be, but I enjoyed it.
Yeah, we haven't watched it yet. It's on our list of things to do. So I do have three very personal questions. What's your favorite food?
I thought you'd ask that. Well, I do like cheese. I like different kinds of cheese. We can leave it like that. And I like lots of foods. I don't have allergies.
foods or anything like that. So,
do you cook?
Yes, I cook. I'm not gourmet. I like to barbecue and things like that, yeah.
Okay. Do you have any pets?
I have two peacocks.
That's right. Brian told me you had a peacock. That is so cool. Do you have a male and a female? Or
I do have a male and a female now. That all just shifted really recently because I had two males, and I finally set up for my neighbor to give me a peahen. And then one of my males got sick, and he just stopped eating. He passed away. So I have a male and a female. So hopefully in the spring they'll have some eggs. That'd be cool.
Brian said that he, I guess, was watching one of your videos and heard. I mean, I know what a peacock sounds like. That is so cool. How do they fare in the winter? What are they okay?
Yeah, I just make sure they get lots of food and they've got a shelter so they can get out of the wind and the rain. And I think they'd rather be in the summer. But, you know, if they're healthy, they're fine in the winter here. It goes down to about zero, sometimes a little bit less, but I just make sure they got lots of good food so they can, you know, maintain energy level.
Where did you get your first peacock? Like, how did you decide this was going to be a pet? Are they tame?
They're almost maintenance free. Years ago, 15 years ago, something like that, I was living with a woman and we had a lot of animals on this property, and we had hens and roosters. And one time she came home with a peacock, and I said, what are you doing with the peacock? She said, oh, he'll be fine. The woman left about half a year later, and so I was left with a lot of animals. So I got rid of the hens and the roosters, and I found him a mate. And so he was very happy to have a mate. And that was like 15 years ago. So I've had peacocks about that long.
They live a long time, huh?
Maybe 25 years if everything's good.
Wow. Can you, like, pet them, touch?
No, they don't like that. So anytime I go in the cage, they always go to the other end of the cage. They just want food and water, basically, and to be left alone. So they're pretty easy in terms of maintenance.
All right. I love it. My last question is about music. So clearly you play music. If you have a grand piano and a bass guitar and you play them both, what kind of music do you like to listen to?
Well, I grew up in the 60s and that, so I like good rock and roll. I like blues. I got into jazz for a little while, but that's kind of faded. So I would say rock and blues.
Well, Paul, this has just been a delightful conversation. I mean, frame building, peacocks, blues, rock and roll. It just doesn't get better than that. We've been speaking with Paul Brody. If you are interested in learning more about him, tell my listeners how they can find you.
You go to YouTube, you can type in Paul Brody Shop. If you want to email me, I'm fussyframebuilder@gmail.com. I have a website, flashbackfab.com. You can see a lot of my archive projects there.
You also wrote a book.
I did. It's called Paul Brody, the Man Behind Brody Bikes. I still have a few copies left. You can also find them on Amazon. Yeah, since the YouTube video started up, I've sold a few more books. So I guess people are clicking on the link there.
That's a good thing. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today. It's been a delightful conversation. I hope we get to actually meet sometime. Maybe NABS will come back around, and I know you've been to NABS before. Would you go back if Don does another Sacramento show?
It's possible. I don't know. I did six shows in a row. We did six shows in a row.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I've done some time down there.
Well, I think we've actually crossed paths at one of those shows in the past, so regardless, it's been just a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Diane. It's been good for me, too.
All right. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Paul Brody joined me from his home in British Columbia. As he said, you can contact him at fussyframebuilder@gmail.com with any questions you might have. You can take a look at his videos on the Paul Brody YouTube channel, or you can browse his extensive archives on his website, flashbackfab.com. So let's take a short break, and when we come back, Lou Mazzanti, test editor for Bicycling Magazine, takes us through a few inexpensive gift ideas in our first of the three segments for the upcoming holidays. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We're back. It's the Outspoken Cyclist, and that's me, Diane Jenks. Yep, they're coming around the bend sooner than you might think, and I figured it was none too soon to start thinking about holiday gift giving, especially since many of us will be ordering online this year. The disclaimer, as you'll hear right at the beginning of my conversation with Bicycling Magazine's Lou Mazzanti, he's the test editor, is whether these products will be available in time for holiday gift giving. So maybe ordering sooner rather than later isn't such a bad idea. Also, I'd like to preface my conversation with a correction. Lou is the test editor, not tech editor of the publication, as you'll hear me mistakenly say during our conversation. Hi, Lou. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being my guest and getting us ready for holiday gift-giving season. Doesn't even seem possible, does it?
I can't believe it's already here. I hope there's products available for everybody. And thanks for having me on the show, too. It's great to talk to you, Diane.
Of course. Well, I forgot, you know, like everybody's looking for product. Well, maybe we'll see what kind of domestic stuff we can find, even though all of that is gone, too. Well, let's come up with some ideas anyway. I thought we'd talk about friends and family gifts for under $100 and maybe some safety items. So what you got, Mr. Tech Editor?
I love this category because there's some really fantastic values, but all of these products are very specialized too. They solve real problems. So they make fantastic gifts. So not only is it less money out of your wallet or pocketbook or your Apple Pay, it is definitely something that is really meaningful and helpful for your friends and family. So we've got a couple of really cool options here. A lot of these gift ideas are products that we recently covered at Bicycling in our Gear of the Year issue, which is out now, where we did the 100 best products. So I definitely stole some ideas from there. And these are either products that I've used myself and love, or that other test editors at Bicycling have used and recommend for others. So let's dive in with what I think are some really cool products under $100. One of the neatest, I think, out there, and this is a super valuable product, especially for mountain bikers, is a $25 product called the Timber Bell. It is a simple bell that you attach to your handlebar. It either has a silicone strap mount or you can screw it on. And the neat thing about this bell is it actually has an on-off switch, or you can turn it down. So we all know the benefits of riding with a bell, whether you're on a mountain bike trail and you want to alert other users, or you're on a bike path for the same reason. You don't want to ride up behind anybody and potentially frighten them. You know, a bell is a nice way to let other people know that you are coming and they can be prepared. The problem with some bells is either you have to manually ding them, which is great on a bike path, but not always practical on a mountain bike, or they don't shut up. This one does both. It has a nice, like a kind of like a cowbell. It's got a nice little sound. But if you are climbing or you just in an area at a time that you don't need the bell on, it has a little switch you can flip and turn the sucker off.
What a cool idea. Yeah, we use a bell on the paths. Actually, when I think about it, I think a bell is required here in Northeast Ohio, or maybe in the whole state. That's really cool. So tell me again who the maker is, and do you have a website for it?
The maker is Timber Bell. And the website is mtbbell.com.
Very cool. All right. Oh, that sounds like a great gift. Great idea. I love the idea of an on-off switch. How cool is that?
Yeah, it's really great on mountain bike trails, too. And the other benefit is, I don't know how many of you listeners have young kids. I certainly do. You can attach that to their bikes. And if they happen to speed away from you around a corner in the forest, you can still hear them and know where they are and rest a little bit easier. They haven't gone miles away from you.
Great idea. Excellent. What else you got?
Cool. This one is super practical. Again, a little bit more mountain bike focused, but the Stans Dart system, which is a tubeless tire puncture plug repair system, all in one, just came out this year. It's super awesome. I don't know how much mountain biking your readers do. If you do ride and you ride tubeless, plugging those tires has never been an easy or entirely efficient or effective way to repair them. It happens. Sometimes you get lucky. Most of the times you don't. This is the one system I've used that actually works, and it's easy to use. It's really well thought out. Most plug systems are kind of mechanical. You're just trying to jam some like rubber or other substance into a hole and hope it doesn't let any air leak out. This one uses a chemical reaction between the Stans sealant, which obviously they're recommending you're running, and the plug itself to form what they say is an airtight chemical bond on there. Then the applicators are super easy to use too. It's got a tiny little plastic dart that won't hurt your rim strip if you do slam that tire down on your rim later on. You don't have to trim it when it's done. It's just got these little feathery dart-like things that kind of just blend into the rubber. The applicator's got a core removal tool on it. So if you're carrying a little vial of Stans with you on your ride, you can put some more in there if you've flirted it out all over the trail. It just is really convenient, really easy to use. $25, fantastic gift for anyone in mountain bikes.
So will it also work on a larger tire, like a cross bike, maybe even a 622 700C or anything wide and kind of gnarly with tubeless?
It should. I mean, I've used it on all types of mountain bike tires really effectively. You know, I think higher pressure obviously makes it a little bit harder. You got to be a little bit more precise with that seal.
That's true.
I think, yeah. But if you're running tubeless, I should double check that if it would actually work on kind of road and cross tires.
Yeah, I'm not so worried about road. I was just thinking if you're on gravel and, you know, you're just not using a 26 or even a 29er. But a 29er is really a 700. And if you're going wide, it should work, I would think. It's just such a cool idea.
Yeah, absolutely. It's fantastic.
What else you got?
In addition to those four gifts, this was an awesome find for me for a lot of reasons. It's a new company based out of California from somebody with a lot of bike industry experience. It's called Memory Pilot, and they make one. They do kind of custom number plates for bike shops, but they also have started producing socks, and there's these really fantastic socks that are compressive. They look great. They're breathable. They're high quality. They feel awesome. And they're 12 bucks. They're called the Watt Style socks. He replaces the colors every quarter or so. He's coming out with some new additions. Eric Saunders is the owner. Memory Pilot is one of the very few BIPOC owned gear brands in cycling. So supporting that brand feels very important right now. He's doing a great job of trying to make cycling products more accessible, offering people a really fantastic experience that he's had at affordable prices. So the Watt Style socks are 12 bucks. Just this year, he came out with a lower price sock, even that he's calling the standard awesome bike riding sock. And he's selling these for $6. A great name, super cool sock, $6. Anybody can get into a fabulous pair of socks. It just makes them feel and look really cool.
And everybody knows you can never have too many pairs of socks.
Absolutely.
Right.
You don't need to start riding in a pair of old tube socks or something that doesn't fit into your cycling shoes.
Right.
You want that great experience right from the start. Memorypilot.com.
Okay. So far we have this cool bell. We have Stans Dart system, which I really like that idea. I know how difficult these tubeless tire flats can be. And then Memory Pilot socks. Do you have anything else for us for the under $100 idea?
I do have one more.
Okay.
A cool little thing. This has been on my shopping list for a while right now. It is the Feedback Chain Keeper. And I'm not sure how familiar you are with these chain keepers, but it's a simple little device. You can slide it right into your dropout if you're washing your bike or traveling with your bike, and it'll hold that chain if you remove your wheel in place of your cassette, which allows you, if you're washing your bike, then to actually be able to spin your chain, to clean your chain a little bit easier. It just makes that whole process, especially in the fall when we may be wetter or muddier rides and you want to wash it afterwards, makes the process just super simple, really easy to get a good clean without any hassle.
Yeah, and feedback makes a lot of cool products for the bicycle industry, but I didn't really realize this one. Well, Lou, this has been great. We have four nice products for the beginning of our gift-giving season. We will talk again next week. How would that be? And we will we'll come up with some more techie ideas.
Yeah, I'd be happy to come back next week and talk about some tech. There's some really cool stuff happening there, too.
All right. Lou Mezzante, he is the Bicycling Magazine, one of their tech editors, giving us some gift ideas for holiday. Talk next week, Lou. Thanks.
Thank you, Diane.
All righty. Bye-bye. My thanks to Lou Mezzante and to Paul Brody for joining me on the show this week. Next week, we'll have part two of our gift ideas with Lou Mezzante from Bicycling, and a conversation with Strong Town's Chuck Marone on a couple of very interesting topics. Remember that you can always join the conversation on our Facebook page, and you can find links to most of what we talked about there. You can leave a comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com, where there's a synopsis of the show each week, as well as a playback button. Or you can send us a tweet at OutspokenCyclist without the E. I hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great week. Please stay safe, stay well, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show, and we welcome your thoughts and comments. We'll be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and most other podcast apps, and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.